Okay, welcome to the first Transatlantic Conversation podcast. Today we will talk at least partly about the new Biden administration in the US, but also developments on global scale and how we see some of those from the German perspective. We have several texts that some of us at least partly read, and I will just start with one of small parts of one of the texts. Let's listen into it. Now I was the only one listening to it, so let's share the sound. Let's go.
As always, black people waited longer than others to vote and were more likely to have their votes challenged. They were more likely to be suffering or dying from COVID-19 and less likely to be able to take time away from work. The historical protection of their right to vote has been removed by the Supreme Court's 2013 ruling in Shelby County v. Holder, and states have rushed to pass measures of kind that historically reduced voting by the poor and communities of color.
So this is a topic we also mentioned in different talks already, that by creating narratives, there are also always winners and losers. And here we just heard that especially minorities were those who suffered the most from telling, no, we won't allow early voting, we don't want to allow votes by post. And I know it's hard to comment on that yet, but if you want to add your ideas already, feel free to do so. Alternatively, I will.
Yeah, I think that from the American Abyss article by John Snyder, isn't it?
Yes.
And as far as I know, he, or as far as I understood it, he divides the Republican Party into gamers and breakers. And basically, the gamers being the Republicans that try to stay in power whilst having less than half of the votes of the country by gerrymandering, which is like stuff like that, and getting, or gerrymandering, I don't know if I should explain it or not. Are you familiar with the term? Pushing minorities and majorities around the country. And I think by that he describes what the gamers used to do, or what kind of influence it had on the black people. But it also highlights that there's not only a political disadvantage that they have, but also a social, or like basically human, or like how would you say it? Like the fact that they can get access to Medicare since they suffered more from COVID-19. I think it's also interesting that that could possibly be connected to the gerrymandering and being pushed in certain parts of certain cities, and stuff that goes on, or like stuff that comes with the gerrymandering. Yeah.
Maybe to add on the gamers and breakers, just this short quote, also from the same text. Share some.
For some Republicans, the invasion of the Capitol must have been a shock or even a lesson. For the breakers, however, it may have been a taste of the future. Afterward, 8 senators and more than 100 representatives voted for the lie that that had forced them to flee their chambers.
Just to put that in context, I don't know if well, as you know about on 6th of January, many people entered the capital, and people see that as a queue. But there's not only people entered the capital, but also afterwards, senators and representatives voted that the whole election was wrong. And that, I don't know if it never happened, but at least for many years, no one in this more generally ceremonial gathering voted against an election. So just that as Benedict says or said, there were people that really want to go through with it, even within the political parties, and that was something that worried many. Were more worried about politicians being or wanting to do such a thing than just citizens going into the capital. I have to.
Well, I don't know if it's the time now to maybe we'll bring in a discussion, but since both topics came up, geomandering and the storm on the Capitol, I had a discussion with a friend about it who was very critical with the way that German media was perceiving that event in Washington. He said that the wording and the framing of German media with regards to DC, to Washington, was a little bit too much, was a little bit over the top. That was not an event of threat to democracy or similar headlines, which were used by German media. He said that was all over the top. If you look at just basic frauds in democracy that the USA is having, such as geomandering, such as donations to parties without limits or without transparency, or such as healthcare systems, such as Abu Ghraib and secret military courts, all of that are undemocratic institutions and undemocratic happenings. So to come now and to now try to bring up the threat of democracy because some rioters ran into Capitol, and I'm not trying to relativate the symbolic power that this happening had, just to put it into context to other frauds of democracy that the USA is maybe experiencing. He was just feeling that German media was just being over the top when they were reporting from what happened in DC, and bringing up geomandering. So I just thought maybe this would be an idea that we could sting onto whether the USA has way bigger problems than a couple of rioters running into parliament. And eventually, well, some might argue it was luck, some might argue it was strategic, nothing happened, right? So, well, nothing happened. It was a symbolic act that happened, but electoral processes have not been disturbed or such as. So he was bringing up that point, and I thought it was quite interesting. I personally would not agree 100% because I think it's not a black and white game, and something can be a threat to democracy while there are also undemocratic happenings going on. And I don't think it's either you are 100% democracy and only then your democracy can be threatened. I wouldn't agree with that approach, but I found that thought interesting. And since both topics came up now, I thought I'd bring it in.
Well, chime into that, I think that's really an interesting thought, but I think if you just, like the way your friend or the comparison was made is that there are these certain real democracy fraud threats, like the ones you mentioned, the big PACs, I think it's called, when with the huge corporations being able to basically support a political party without any regulations and stuff like that, or the military courts that aren't democratically legitimized. But I don't think you can compare them to the storming of the Capitol to just a bunch of rioters going in there. I think you have to also put that into context, which was that the current, like the sitting president, or at that point still sitting president, had a speech which inspired all these people to go there. And he actively rallied the people and encouraged them to go there. And I think since that president still had, I think, 47% of voters in the last election, so 47, or like a, let's say a huge portion of the country behind him, and that he's able to get people to do such things, it's quite a threat to democracy. Or actually, like, it shows how big the threat is that he's able to do that. And therefore, I think the language used in German media is okay to describe that and not over the top, from my opinion.
What I think was interesting is that German media was focused on the people rioting into the Capitol, and it was really 1 week only this, even though there were also Corona went on, and we know that for 1 year it was nearly the only thing that was mentioned in the news, at least in the first minutes always. So that really means something. And what I also thought was interesting is that people use January 6th as they use 9/11. So they really try to put it in a real big picture and maybe also overestimate the meaning of it. And this might be something we just know in 10 years, because one of the texts is about how lies develop in a country and how a narrative goes on and on. And the narrative of having a wrong election and Trump actually winning the election and then senators and representatives supporting that. So it's not only one politician who plays this card of lying, but he gets support from others who also themselves have support from different parts of the country, etc. So this might be the bigger problem, that even within the democratic establishment, or democratic meaning not the party, but those who were voted democratically, that they also strengthened this lie. And this might be something that in 4 years, in 8 years, in 12 years still might play a role in the next elections, when once again one or two states, there are things that could be questioned. So the democracy, the whole voting process itself might never be again accepted by a larger portion of society. And that's something I don't know. In this sense, I think it wasn't mentioned too much in Germany in the news. In Germany, it was only about how, I don't know, I think 800 people entered the Capitol. And then afterwards, we also know that representatives and senators feared for their life. So that's nothing that was there from the first day in the news. But then afterwards, representatives told their story, and then also the picture changed in some way.
I want to agree on that point, because I really think that it could be a complicated topic in the future, because every vote will be or might be different than it was now, you know, or in the future it will be a bit different, because just how Trump and all the Republicans or all the guys who followed him reacted was like, I think it, like it's never been before. So I think, especially how the media reacted to it, a lot of guys could think or could act the same way in the future if they would lose the vote, for example. But on the other hand, I think it's just going to be interesting, because I think it could go either way, because you never know if the next Republican is, let's put it that way, that or as crazy as Trump is, you know, reacting on things like that, because you also never had a guy like him as a president before, you know. So I don't really know if it's going to be the same way in like 4 years or 8 years, if a Democrat wins over a Republican, or if it's going to be like before, maybe, you know. I think it's going to be interesting because it was just so weird this time. And I don't know, for me, it was just unbelievable. This guy is just standing there saying, no, I won, but he obviously lost, you know. I just saw an interview earlier today and it was the same way. He was still, I think he had his first speech today or yesterday. It was just, I don't know. I think it's always just, for me, it's more comedy than actual input he's given. But on the other hand, so many people are believing in the stuff he's saying, which brings people to go to the Capitol or do things which maybe as a German or for, I don't know, people from other places in the world are kind of unimaginary, you know. So I think it's going to be an interesting time in the next years to just watch the US and the US politics and see how they react on things now.
Well, maybe just to take the point of the devil's advocate here and go a little bit more in another direction, maybe one could argue that the election of Joe Biden now and was the perfect incident to show and prove that American democracy is working perfectly fine. Looking at different definitions of democracy, at least once you'll find the definition that democracy means that a minority can enact themselves to become the majority. So that there is the institutional context for minorities to gather, to vote for the streets, to get the public opinion, the court of public opinion on their side, and through terms of Wahlkampf, I don't know what the term is in English, to use all those means and enact themselves as a majority. And this is what happened, right? Trump was in power for 4 years. Democrats were in the minority. They used the institutional means that the US Constitution gives them and enacted themselves to become the majority again in the country. They had a change of parliament and they had a change of presidency. And of course, on a personal note, Trump was being really childish and was being really immature with how the election went on. And yet there was, for me at least, and I think for a lot of other people, no real doubt that he would leave office. I mean, sure, there were like those horror scenarios that what happens if he has the military on his side and what happens if they come again, back again. Then again, you have like a very settled constitution, an institutionalized constitution, which has different checks and balances systems there and different responsibilities for different kinds of use of power. So actually, just to be the devil's advocate here, right? Some might argue this was the perfect example for how US democracy is working exactly how it should. A minority Democrats became the majority through elections. They have a new president in power now. Old president is gone. There's even an impeachment process going on against him. So some might argue, what do you want? How is our democracy fragile, right? Because of course, it's always something different if you have a bipartisan system such as the US, and obviously one has to win and it's a 50-50 chance. But still, if you adapt that model of the minority being able to enact themselves as a majority, some might argue it worked perfectly fine in the US.
Yeah, I think those are some interesting points, and I think they, if you look at it from a very basic level and don't go into details as much and only take into definition of democracy that the minority has to have the ability to become the majority, I think you're actually right. But I think democracy, like, I know that I'm arguing against the devil's advocate's opinion, not yours. But I'm just like, for easiness sake, I'll just say your opinion. Okay.
That's not a problem. Nothing taken on a personal
note. Okay. Okay. Against your definition of democracy, I think it also has to have a certain political culture in order to work. There need to be certain institutions in place that should generally be accepted, or if they're not accepted, basically the democracy can't work, such as courts of law, the legislative houses, I don't know, branches of the executive, and so on. And I think that there was a huge disregard for these institutions coming with the cry for election fraud, because Trump basically put himself above all institutions and everything that's factual. And by that, and his voters following, which is also a point the article raises, which I found to be very interesting, basically it was that if you want to follow everything Trump says, since everything he says, or like a lot of the stuff he says, is wrong and so contradictory, you basically have to take him as the only source of truth, because everything else wouldn't make sense. So once you have people following him to that extent, they also won't follow the democratic institutions anymore. And the article also said that some Republican, like, they draw a really dark scenario for the future, which would be that a breaker candidate narrowly loses the election in 2024. And the Republicans control the House, like, so the Senate and the House at that time, and that they then would decide to challenge the election, since they also have the people in the street rallying up and going against the election, and it would be very easy to overturn. And like, let's really hope that does not happen. But if that if that would be the case, I think people would look back at it and say, by not accepting his election defeat, Trump basically built the first stone for that new election challenge. So I think if you look at it with a little more detailed view and also really shed some light to the aspects I just mentioned, I think you could say the US democracy has a huge problem.
Let me just share what you just paraphrased, because I also thought that was an important aspect.
The force of a big lie resides in its demand that many other things must be believed or disbelieved. To make sense of a world in which the 2020 presidential election was stolen requires distrust not only of reporters and of experts, but also of local, state, and federal government institutions, from poll workers to elected officials, Homeland Security, and all the way to the Supreme Court. It brings with it of necessity a conspiracy theory. Imagine all the people who must have been in on such a plot, and all the people who would have had to work on the cover-up.
And I think that also makes the devil's case, because it shows that all those institutions, they worked, and that's why there was no big fraud, at least. Of course, some minor things always might happen, but there was no big voter fraud, and especially this election shows how things get to a normal democracy, also in the sense of the majority winning in the United States, because the 2016 election was actually the minority, if you just count the voters, lost, but still the system makes that the Republican Party won. So the US system is complicated, so it's hard to, from just one example, decide if it's working or not working. And I think the first quote that we heard about minorities, black voters, poor communities, that actually shows where the US democracy might need to improve, because democracy also means one person, one vote, and every vote counts the same. And that might not be the case in the system right now. If we want, we can also turn a little bit to a more looking perspective, because it's one thing how people in the United States realize their own democracy, or how we think about democracy from an US perspective. But I think it's also interesting how different parts of the world, different countries who as such have a different idea of how democracy or how politics should work, how they will use the big lie, or how just use how things just worked out in the US. So let us listen something about how the US sees itself as the hegemon, and how they want to come back to the top of the table. Share sound.
With US primacy, the world is a place where differences can be resolved peaceably. Without it, the planet descends into a dog eat dog, might makes right environment. The question for Gates is not whether the United States should reign, but how it should do so. A defter hand, he hopes, will restore the country to its necessary role. This restoration would, as Biden has put it, place America back at the head of the table.
I don't know if you, probably not, but I just listened a bit into this year's Munich Security Council, I think. And there the narrative was always the US is back, and then other politicians said thank you for the US to being back and leading again, etc. So this is also interesting how there were 4 years the US obviously was not leading because they were focusing on their own turf, but now they're back and they want to lead again, what is great in some sense, because it's important to go together working against climate change, etc. But on the other hand, in 4 years, it seems that at least in some parts of the world, things haven't gone on in the normal way, because everyone was waiting for the US to be back. And last year, Biden was also at the Munich Security, I don't know, is it Council? Conference, Munich Security Conference. And he said the US will be back. And then this year, he was thanked for keeping his promise. So this is also very interesting on how democracy works in the US, how it affects the world, and then how other politicians feel the necessity to maybe wait for US democracy in some sense.
I just think it's like, at just 4 years we have spent without the US on top. So maybe it would take more time to find a kind of new leader for the world. But the US is back in just 4 years. So it's like nobody claim the chair and they go back on the chair. But I think it's also a useful thing. I mean, they have like a super strong economy and a powerful military. So maybe they are in the most way, probably not in every way, a good leader of the world, better than Chinese.
Yeah, I think that's, I don't even think there is a another leader than the US, because like in a democratic way, because who else is there? You can't take Russia, you can't take China as a leader. So basically there is just, you know, economic point of view, and in so many different other points of view, there is just the US to be a leader, because when you don't have the US, there's so many other countries, even Germany, who are maybe powerful, but there's no one who's big enough or powerful enough to be a real leader over other countries. Let's put it that way. And I think that's hard. And if the US is back, let's say back, and back in their role as a leader, I think that's what everyone follows, because like Lucas said, I think especially in the economic point of view, it's just the most powerful country or democratic powerful country in the world. And you need a country like that to be on your side, you know? And I think that's why it's so important for all the other countries like us too, that the US is back now.
Well, I think that's quite an interesting point. Like, I see that it's, for example, like from a Western and democratic point of view, I guess it's better to have the US as the superpower or the hegemonial of the world. Let's put it this way. But I'm not really sure if they're still fit to fill that role. For example, looking at the historic implications of that role, in the article, it mentions that in 1939, some London representative came over to the US and basically asked them to take that role from Great Britain. And President Roosevelt at first didn't like it, but then when France was also taken over by Nazi Germany and the Second World War kept going on, they eventually decided to take on that role, and in 1945, they basically had military implications all over the world, and they kept them since then. But one reason they were able to keep them is because in the article it says that the US economy was four times stronger than, stronger than all the economies coming after that combined, or all the top five economies coming after that combined. And I don't think the US can still keep that up, since I don't think the US economy is stronger than, for example, China and India combined, or China and Russia combined. And I think China is actually on pace to beat the US economy, if I'm correct, but happy to be corrected. And I think it takes a certain amount of basically economic power to also keep up that kind of defense spending and being the policeman all over the world. And if they can't keep it up, it will basically lead to the US only being able to intervene when the national interest of the US is attacked, which by definition, or like by just the fact that they can only intervene when the national interest of the US is attacked, would make them a bad policeman of the world, since you wouldn't want a policeman who only intervenes when his own interests are attacked. That's basically my point. So I'm not quite sure if the US can be back as it was, and I don't know if it should be, but maybe they should cut back on defense spending and just try to keep Russia and China in check, and by that we can also have a peaceful triple hegemonial world order. I don't know. Yeah, that's basically also, like, it's kind of taken from the article, but I found that point to be very interesting.
I think that if you look at hegemonial powers, I would personally divide the influence of the United States in three sectors. You have the economical hegemonial power, you have the cultural slash political power, and you have the military power of the United States. And from my point of view, I would argue that with regards to military power, they are still the hegemonial power in the United, in the world. Well, it's not just their army, but it's also their entire branch of industry, which is connected to military and military spendings. With regards to economical hegemonial status, I would probably argue that they are losing their status. I wouldn't say that they have lost it already, because even during times when Donald Trump was president, they had still corporations and companies seated in the United States, which were dominant in all sectors regarding technology, regarding finance. So in certain important broad industries, the United States still seats the most important players in the industry. And therefore, I would argue their economical status hasn't changed, no matter who's seated in the White House. Well, with regards to political and cultural status in the world, I would say they have lost immensely in the last 4 years. This is due to, first, of course, the backup of Donald Trump of multilateralism, being who supplies the third world and developing countries with vaccines, with medical products. Who does that? Well, we see nowadays that China and Russia is doing this. Most of the nations in Africa are being supplied and import nowadays the vaccines coming from that part of the region. Same for infrastructural projects that are being conducted there. All of that is financed from another part of the world, especially, and that's the change with regards to how it was 30, 40 years ago. Also in cultural hegemonial status, I think the USA is losing a lot. You have, just as a very stupid and childish example maybe, but you have TikTok, which is used by billions of people nowadays and is a Chinese software developer. You will find it on Facebook and Instagram and all those platforms that you'll see more and more of Chinese or Asian content on those platforms. So in that regard, in cultural and political hegemonial power, I would say they have lost it already, and they will be losing it even more in future. This is not only with regards to their role in international conferences and multilateralism as such, but also with regard to just other arising and emerging cultural powers, such as China, who now, after having had an immense economical boom, just focus on cultural expansion nowadays. You'll find Confucius centers all over the world nowadays. The number of those institutions have doubled, tripled over the last year. So they now spend or expand their cultural influence as well. So I would say with regard to cultural and political influence, they have lost it, and they will be losing it in future even more. Economically speaking, I think they still will be top of the world, since like the most important key factors or key industry players are still seated in the United States. And militarily, they are still, for me, untouched. Well, I'm not really into military or security policies at all. That's not like my field of profession or something. But from my just amateur perspective, I would argue that in military regards, we still heavily depend on them and can trust them. So their hegemonial status in that regard is untouched for me. But with cultural and political status, they have lost it, and they will be losing it in future. That's what I think, or my personal opinion is.
I think those are some really interesting points, and I really like the way you divided the parts of hegemonial power. I just have basically a question for you, something that came up my mind. So it's a question for everybody. How would you say these parts of hegemonial powers are connected to each other? Because I think they all kind of enable and disable each other. If you are not the hegemonial power in one field, you can't be. It basically disables your ability to be the hegemonial power in that field for a long time. Which, if I put it to an example, I mean, it's, for example, as you said, I think the military, being the main military power, basically also commands which part of political culture and cultural goods in generally are spread throughout the world, and how good your economy is also, I think, I'm also not an expert in military spending and military politics, but I think your military basically also heavily depends on your economy, since if you don't have any household income, which comes from the economy to basically spend it on a huge military, I think in the long term, it will also go down. So my point kind of being that there could be a domino effect, like if they lose the cultural point, I think the economies of the other countries could get stronger, and then like a domino, the economy would fall and then the military hegemonial position would fall. Or that's something that just came out of my mind. What do you think about it?
Well, I think that's right. I think those three branches are really connected to each other. And I think you see that when you look back in history, after 1990, 1991, when the Western world had won over Soviet Union, you saw that you saw McDonald's and Hollywood movies all over the world. You had Metallica as the American metal band playing concerts in Moscow. You had like the extreme, well, that was the result of a military hegemonial status enacted and cultural hegemonial status, and coming with that cultural hegemonial status, having US companies being abroad and spreading fastly and vastly abroad, you had, of course, that economical hegemonial power coming with you. So I would agree with you, those are interconnected, and the division that I just made is artificial. It's like not a real division that you will find in real life. But yet, with regards to the second point that you said, how our military and economical power, how they are intertwined, I might be disagreeing with you on this point, because I think that economical power from the United States is nowadays especially coming from their finance and their tech industry. And those industries, of course, have intersections with military and military spendings as well. But those private corporations, they make profits other than producing weapons, right? So the entire Silicon Valley is making profits with data, is making profits with surveillance. The entire finance industry, of course, is interconnected with military spendings as well, but they are everywhere. They're like in every branch, they're in every industry, and it's not just military. So I think because there's a bigger diversification of income in the economical situation of the United States, other than in the 50s, in the 60s, where everything that you gained was basically military industry, right? So I think we've lost that connection. We now have a more diversified field of economy, being finance and tech industry as the main carriers of that industry. And therefore, I think you can make that division. But of course, that division is artificial. I would agree with you. This is all connected. This is what imperialism is, right? You expand militarily, you expand your culture, having like new markets that you sort of won. You can have your companies spending products and services over there. So of course, your economy will rise on the same scale. But I think that division is artificial, just to like be a little bit more differentiated where they are losing power, where they are mainly gaining power, maybe where they have lost power already. Yeah, that's what I meant.
I think what's also important to remember is that our society is much more interconnected with US society than, for example, with China's society. It starts with us knowing to speak English, but as I think no one speaks Chinese or Mandarin, it goes on by the historical interconnection from the Second World War, how the US supported the rebuilding of Germany, or in fact of many parts of Europe. So from a European perspective, we might not even realize how things have changed, even though this 4 years for sure made a difference, because we just couldn't understand the administration that well anymore. Of course, there were also beforehand, there were differences, and already with wars the US started, many Europeans didn't understand, or at least in Germany, there were larger groups who disagreed. Though we don't know exactly how people in African countries realize how China has supported them in the last 20 years, how they built harbors, etc., how they even own the harbors, and how this will make a difference in the upcoming years. And then there's also the population of China that is so big that only this makes a difference already on how things develop. Though what for me is important that we might even try not to have this division into countries. So we say the US needs to take care that Russia and China doesn't develop to be the new hegemon or the new hegemons. And I understand completely that the systems are so differently, and there's much less freedom in other countries just because the surveillance is there, state-owned in some sense. So I understand that this is not nearly our system and also not where we want to head to. But on a more personal level, why one Chinese person is different from one person from the US or one person from Russia. I don't see a major difference on this more personal level. And then I ask myself, is there not a way to also implement this equality also on the states level, and to lessen this, it's not nationalist, but still we always talk in about nation and how one nation develops and makes a difference for other parts. So this is something I try to find new ideas.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point, and also a question that there's no valid reason why it should, or from a philosophical or just looking at a human kind of view, there's no reason for these different nations to exist. But I think they are struck, most nations, or at least I'd say most nations in the world, they had a huge growing process which took a lot of time, merged cultures together, and and then these cultures developed, and they developed in different directions. And I think it's really hard to break open these structures and these cultural differences. Even though we live in a more globalized world than ever, I still think that you would have to basically start at a very, very early level of the man's development, or mankind's development, basically, put it all on the same, with the same instincts or same aspects of culture that are being the most relevant ones in said part of the world. And I think that's just because of the different geological implications that there are, and the way people have to work together in different parts of the world. For example, in the Mediterranean area, you could easily go off by yourself. Just very simple example from a cultural standpoint, you can easily go off by yourself and say, I don't need the community, I'm just going to have my own farm and live happily. But if you live in a more extreme climate, you can't do that. You're basically dependent on getting together with other people. So like, for example, let's say if you're in a very, very cold area, you have to stick together and form a culture. I think these kind of issues can be tackled in a globalized world, but I think it's still very hard, and to find a common denominator for all these people to bring them together and not develop different cultures, which for me would be the first step to break open these national borders, is really, really hard. I hope my point kind of came across. Basically, it's that the cultures create the nations, and the way the cultures are created is also deeply enrooted in the geopolitical context of one's place where he or she grows up.
Yeah. I mean, on an organizational level, this is completely true, and of course, it's hard to imagine how we organize small scale projects on a global level, but then they go back to very local communities that have to deal with those. But the narrative of nations and to create differences, this is something that might come from cultural and even geographical differences, but they are also supported nowadays because there's gain for some people, and of course to have strict outward borders, not borders in a geographical way, but just to say this is our group, this also helps to keep people together. But for example, one of the texts, and I have this also play, but I think this is a short one. There it says, after 9/11, Bush asked why Al-Qaeda hates the US. And then he says, it's because we love freedom. And now hate is a strong word, and this is also a special case. But also if we just go on in a more abstract level, to say that differences between countries are there because one country doesn't accept the freedom of the other one, or one group doesn't like the freedom of the other one. Sometimes it feels that this is only to show differences, and in fact there are other reasons. And I thought for me, it's funny how, since maybe the last 10 years, we often hear that the US focus has turned to the Pacific and China is growing. And first, the US and the West wanted to include China into the market. And by that, China changed also its political system. And nowadays, politicians realize that China won't change because they're already strong enough to develop their own ways. But then it's hard to come together. And I don't know the answer how to come together, but I have the sense that it's not the priority of many politicians, but also not of many societies to try to come together, maybe on some projects, because we realize that climate change is something really global. So there is something we need to work on together. But even there, you can gain some personal profit from that. So even there, it's hard to cooperate. Yeah. So you might have ideas how to bring countries together that seem to be not partners, but struggling for the first position, the pole position.
I believe that maybe the biggest issue countries have right now, or also the states, always in different terms, because, for example, you just said some comparisons right now. If I may put religion into context, I believe us as a Western country, or all the Western countries, also like the US, always obviously you always have your people who are not like that, but in general, I believe that, for example, Germany or the US are probably very tolerant in case of religion. It doesn't really matter if you're Muslim or Jewish or Christ or whoever. And or some other countries are not. But on the other hand, for example, the issue where I believe is, especially the US has, is the tolerance to also take other countries and other cultures kind of opinion and mindset, because the issue is that the US and us maybe too always think that what we are doing is the best way to do it, you know, it's the right way to do it. And I think that's also why so many countries are clashing with each other, because let's say China, Russia, and the United States all have different ways to approach a thing or a topic or to deal with a crisis, it doesn't matter. But all of them think their way is the best and don't tolerate the other way, other countries' opinion, or just, I don't know, try to work with it, you know? I think that's the biggest issue. I think that's a big issue of the US too, just in the culture and in politics, because they think that we are powerful, we're the best country of the world, what we do is the right way. And if someone is not approaching their way, they're like the stupid ones. And I think that's the big issue. I think it's also hard for countries to, in some topics, in some ways, to work with each other if both parties think they're the best, you know, and no one is approaching the other one. Yeah.
You say interesting point, Yannick. I mean, it's always about if you have maybe a discussion between two peoples, you always think your opinion is maybe the best one. And I think it's always a way to make some compromises to start a democratical process. If states do it, which other it's like top level democratic. Was ist Demokratie nochmal?
Democratic
process. So, yeah, I think it's a way of a democracy between countries and not just inside the country.
Maybe what is an approach for connecting countries again is economical integration. This is maybe an example which has been proven right in the history. I think 80 years ago, no one would have seriously thought that we as Germans would call French people our neighbors and our friends, especially after what happened in two world wars in the beginning of the 20th century. And then just in 1954, when European free trade began and suddenly those countries were codependent on each other due to economical exchange, there was sort of an understanding that grew, that started to happen. You'll see probably a lot of examples throughout history. Germany managed to sort of make their peace with Israel in the 50s with Konrad Adenauer sending German products to Israel and starting economical integration with the countries. You see that nowadays that suddenly the Israelis and the Arab world are growing more together due to codependencies that they have and they see with each other, and economical integration starts to begin. This was an approach that has been tried out and until now has been proven right to some extent to maybe reach a system where there is such a strong codependency of the countries, because one country is really good at that service, the other country is really good at that product or development of that product, or you have global supply chains that just like a spider go all around the world and sort of make a codependency of all the countries with each other. So maybe that is an approach. However, I sometimes have the feeling that we see in Europe nowadays that approach isn't, or just works to a certain extent. If you pass that point, you'll see that there is not much more than economical interests combining and sort of making the connection. And once you reach that point, you have situations like nowadays where we have your member states of the European Union that go into an open clash with other member states, or you have countries that even want to leave the union. So maybe that just works to a certain extent, but it works to a certain extent, right? So maybe that's the best that we got until now, but I'm open for any new ideas. Just saying that this might be one approach to be taken when it comes to, well, not maybe dissolving nations. And maybe I would agree with you, Benedict, on this point, disagree with you, Benedict, that I think nations are very necessary and we need nations. Also in future, we will always need someone to be the sovereign of the people. This is just an essential part of democracy. But this might be, economical integration might be a point to sort of get to that connection.
To first answer your point, I think I also agree there with you that realistically speaking, we always need nations and there will always be nations. But I think if you just look at it from a philosophical point of view, there could also be one sovereign for everybody that is democratically elected, which is not realistic, but I made that statement in that kind of context, just to put it into context. But I think it's an interesting point you raised, because I also wanted to talk about the codependencies and that this way there's a certain common denominator that can be found between the countries, and by this way they're forced to work together. But as you said, I don't think it always has historically proven to be a good approach, because let's say you take the US partnership with Afghanistan about fossil fuels. They had this much in common, basically, or they had one strain that, like, if you have, let's say, five strings of working together and one string of each country strings barely touch each other and everything else was far apart. And I think that it cannot only be economic, but these economic codependencies have to be, again, codependent on a certain cultural exchange and getting to know each other and also having a political exchange. And I think only then this could work and further improve. As you mentioned, in the European Union, it only works to a certain extent, but I also think that the European Union is trying to make it work a little more. For example, that cultural exchange problems, programs like Erasmus or scholarships, I wanted to say, and norms that, so that the DINA norms or certain norms in Europe that a craftsman from Italy can also work in Bulgaria if he wanted to. And I think these are the steps that have to be taken and further be encouraged in order to, or steps like these to kind of build onto these economic codependencies. I agree with you that the economic codependencies basically have to be the first step, or are the easiest first step if you ask me. But I think it's important that both countries agree to have a interest to build on these dependencies. And I think in 2017, the European Commission released the white paper with different scenarios for the future of Europe. And I think some of these can be applied to the world. And one of the scenarios was a Europe of multiple speeds, basically that the countries can decide how much integration they want with each other. And the basic level is economic. on an economic level working together. And I think that by kind of using this model, the world could come together a little more. Certain countries like decide to step up that integration and step it up and step it up, and then more and more join and step the integration up more and more. I hope I got my, basically. So I think that's a way we could build on that, just to add to that point.
Do you think that the countries really got closer by compromise, taking the best of the other country, adapting the other country, takes the best of the other country, etc.? Or was it more a process of the stronger society, the stronger country, stronger culture integrated the other one, so that, for example, Eastern Germany had to integrate into West Germany, or with French, with France and Germany, is it really just getting closer and also accepting differences without wanting to change them, but just differences as are as they are, and we go from that point and accept that also some decisions might be different, and we don't stand on our point of saying our way is the only way.
I think that depends heavily on who you're dealing with as a nation. With regards to the example, Eastern Germany, Western Germany, of course, there was not, like, the Eastern German authorities were not in a position to bargain about which constitution to take, which cultural approach to take. They were not in a position at all to bring that forward. Whereas when you look at the relationship between, I don't know, between Germany and the United States, you would argue that here maybe Germany is in the position where they are not as privileged to bargain when it comes to values or to other aspects of culture. Germany wasn't even able to say anything when Edward Snowden published that the entire American security system was spying on big parts of the world. Germany was, even though they had the political will to grant him asylum, was not doing it. Germany is not talking in the United Nations Security Council about well, unlawful actings of their partners. So I think it depends heavily on which stand you have in that relationship, whether it's an equal eye-to-eye relationship or whether it is a relationship where the dependencies are rather concentrated on one side.
But I will take that point. I think it's there's also a major difference between, because I also like the approach of Miran earlier, maybe having connections between countries on an economical point of view, because I think it's a dangerous bond, and I think it's not a lasting bond, but I think it's an approach, and every approach to make something better is good. But there's also a difference between, let's say, two countries having an economical bond, but just benefit from each other in like a certain point. And once they lose that benefit, the bond is gone again, or they don't have a reason to be on a good trade with each other, or to really have dependencies. And I think that's, for example, why France and, for example, Germany are maybe on a really good term, because there's not one country who's much, much more powerful than the other one. But I think it's maybe even brave, but you also need to have a good connection. You need to kind of be, or show the other one your vulnerability, and to maybe give away some dependencies and take some dependencies, because now both countries are kind of, let's say, equally dependent on each other, which makes them a good partner, because you don't have to be afraid to say something critical or positive, because you know your partners. Like Miran said before, if Germany says something against the state now, they won't even do it because they're not in the position to bargain, to really say something, because they're just looking up to the more powerful country right now. You know, they're much more dependent than the US is from Germany. So that's, I think that's a dangerous part. And that's where you have to go to, maybe to have to try to get more dependencies from each other, to not have too many countries get too powerful. But that's why I also think the approach Benedict said at the end, the European Union is having now, which you could maybe, yeah, bring to the entire world. I think it's not a bad idea, but I think that's also why it's not going to work, because there's no country in the world who is giving up that power. And you have to give up power to get to that point that everyone's kind of like working on that level with each other.
I mean, in some sense, if Europe could, or the EU could be an example, because obviously Germany is in some sense powerful, but it's small, so not so powerful in the end. And as the European Union, at least on the economic level, and that's also some area where the EU is actually the real sovereign, that makes a difference. If the EU bargains with the US, that makes a difference. If it's Germany or even a smaller European country, for the US, it makes not such a difference. And if other parts of the world would also be able to find such agreements where they bundle their necessities and their interests to bargain together, of course, they need to interact and they need to create this interdependencies between each other before, because if it's not in, for example, the African Union, if they don't have this cooperation in between them, they will always have difficulties to bargain hard to the outside. And we see that also with Europe. If the European Union doesn't agree on something internally, there's no strong way to act, for example, to the United States. And that's actually where we saw where the EU worked well together was with Brexit, because there, at least as far as we noticed, the EU had its strategy and they stick to it, and no country, of course, there are always personal countries' interests, but the EU accepted those interests and tried to integrate them in their strategy as a whole. And just as such a working group, you really can get to something, I think. And this would be an interesting development also for other areas, maybe. Because in fact, Eastern Asian countries, they also would like to be able to bargain with China in more of an eye-to-eye way.
No, for sure. I totally agree. The only difference is countries also, like the European Union, are unions of small and not powerful countries. And countries like you said, like China or the US, they won't join a union like that because they are already that powerful, you know? So countries like that will never, or for now, will never sign something or really come to a union or to do something like that, because on their own, they're at least as powerful as the union itself, you know? So why they have no reason to do it, because they don't really benefit from it. Why should they?
If we think about what we talked about, the hegemony, then of course the US, China, in 20 years, maybe India, Russia, they have potential to be such a strong country in the world, because just they have the size, they have the number of people, they have the economy, or might have one day. So in fact, they won't be part of such an alliance. But if we have, I don't know, let's say 20 alliances around the world, and they all are nearly as strong as the other ones, they might also find a way to come together. And now I'm not a historian, but if we think about Europe's development, there were the small European countries, even in Germany, I don't know, some of you might know the exact number, but certainly, I don't know, let's say more than 30 small states in Germany, and they needed to develop a way so that they could talk eye to eye, or they integrated into each other because they saw benefits, etc. So it took a long time to on that road, but I don't have the feeling too much that this is where the global society is going now, or at least I don't see any discussions on a global scale. And of course, this always locally, because you can't implement this for someone. But I would be curious to find such negotiations in other regions of the world, because I think that would be a step forward towards really a world where we can look at one person and see it's a person like me and you. So.
Well, what I think is really important to that, just to add into your point, is what would be the first step for me is to find a platform where the countries or the national interests could be discussed. Like, what do you think? What would be a good platform for these countries to come together? Because they sort of need a reason. If you look at the development of the EU, it started as the Kohle and something agreement, which was basically just the economic platform of mining coal. And I think it's really hard for these countries, or I think that's kind of key to find a platform that could be used as a point where countries could come together. And I think these are really hard to find.
I think it shouldn't be too hard to find, because there should be always some common interest with your neighbors. And of course, there's also always more potential for conflict with your neighbors. And it's a long-term vision, and I'm not sure in how far once people involved the steel and coal coalition, they thought about having the European Union as we have it today. I think they didn't, and maybe one or two already thought about such ideas, but it's one step after the other.
I think I have to say goodbye for now, and I wanted to just make it really quickly to not disturb the round. It was really interesting, and I'm looking forward to see you all hopefully back Monday next month, right? First Monday of the month. That was the plan.
I think the 5th. April.
All right, well,
5th. Yeah.
Well, I'll hope to be prepared then and have read some of the articles that you sent around, Jacob. All right, bye. Have
Thank
a good
much.
Discussion. Bye.
Bye. Yeah, okay, maybe it's just to come back to your point, maybe it's not as hard as I made it out to be to find the common ground, but what would be an incentive for people to think beyond that? Because the way we paved out this vision, it took quite some time, and we come from a background where this kind of vision was implemented and it worked to a certain extent. And I think then it's necessary to spread that vision and to find incentives for people to work together like that. And I don't know if that's really easy, or I don't know what the West, let's put it this way, I don't know what the best way would be to create incentives for these people or these countries.
Just a thought to that. I don't know if it really fits, because I was a little bit late, but aren't there already other like unions also on a political basis in the world? Like, if we see the economic community of Western African states, we do have kind of a situation which is maybe comparable to the EU on certain levels. Like, there's a couple of states which are very bound to each other due to economical reasons, for example, for trade measures, etc. And they also do have a strong security policy. Like I remember in 2017, I think it was, where the situation in the Gambia was, where the elected president was like kind of reinstalled by the members of the, or by other members of ECOWAS due to their military force. I think it's a little bit comparable to what the European Union is maybe still aiming at, namely the enforcement of human rights, etc.
I'm certain that on many, in many regions and on many levels, there are cooperation or cooperations like this. And of course, they all develop in a different way. And it's maybe one of our, or one way to improve things is to research such projects, because then we can compare and we can see what things are working from our Eurocentrical perspective. We could always, firstly, the better the EU works, others will also realize this is a good project. And also, if we want to have a more equal world, it's also a step that the stronger one sometimes gives more than they take. So if, for example, let's take the Western African countries, I'm not certain, but it might be the case that the European Union is still economically and also politically stronger. But to support such projects, we work together and try to put our interests, or at least put them in a perspective with the interests of the others. You could even say, take our interests a step back, but I don't know how realistic that would be for now.
Like I think if we see the debate about the vaccines and the behavior of countries and also of the European Union, I think there is no state and no union which is at the moment willing to step back a little bit.
Well, I adding to that example, I think that there is basically one union which is doing it, which would be the European Union, not to blow the European Union's horn here, but I think they are the only, or as far as I know, they're the only country in which, or the, let's say, the only geopolitical area in which vaccines get produced that also allows the export of these vaccines, because as far as I know, Great Britain and the US, as an example, all the vaccine that's produced inside Great Britain and the US is also staying in the US and Great Britain. And I think Russia and China, for example, are also exporting the vaccines that are produced there. So and they are mainly sharing them with the third world, as far as I know. Or for example, Hungary also ordered some of the vaccines there. So I think it is happening. I'm just not sure if the intention behind it is to put the own interests a step back, but then rather than to implement own economical interests.
I mean, so. Certainly many countries export vaccines, and there are also global organizations like, I think, Gavi, and I think COVAX, that organized by all the G7, G20, by the UN, to also vaccinate in countries where access is difficult, where people or governments don't have money to pay. So there are, of course, projects also on that level. question is always for which reason, and now a pandemic, there's always also a reason. If not the whole world is vaccinated, then the pandemic comes back in some other way. So there's always also self-interest. And this might be okay, but thinking with Kant is always to have the right reason also. So do things for the right reason. And at least from how the European Union wants to put itself or wanted to put itself before, let's say, the Arabic Spring, we saw that those reasons they give to themselves are not always kept. And I understand it's hard, and it's also part of democracy that it's hard, because why one single person in Germany should think that its interest should be less important than interest somewhere else. However, I would like if everyone realizes that own interests, at least when they are nearly all fulfilled, are not as important as interests from someone who is really in need of help or in need of opportunities, at least.
I think that's one way of getting people to step back their own interests, but I think would be also another good way is if it would be possible to outline this global goal and the global benefit each individual would have by helping others as in the long term, as contradictory as it sounds. I think that could also be a really good way to spark the idea of putting your own interest for the moment back. But it also, the problem with that, it also sparks the idea that you only do things now, or you only step back now if you get a big return later, which is not as good, but I think that could be a kind of way to get a lot of people on board.
Normally we talk around 90 minutes, and of course we could tackle a new subject now, but we can also continue this subject, but in general we always get the sense that after 90 minutes the brain juices are at least in some way given to the talk, so it's in part up to you if we continue and how we continue. Just give me small feedback, then we can decide together.
I'm fine with not continuing for now, because I think we've had a really interesting discussion, and I also notice how my focus gets less efficient. What about the others?
I don't really care, to be honest, but I stick with whatever decision is made.
I'm also fine, but I've got to get up early tomorrow. So, I mean, like half an hour or something, I would be still be there, but I don't know if another point is maybe lasting longer.
I think for today that's a good start, and next time we see how it goes, and yeah. So that would be, if it's okay for everyone, the first Transatlantic Conversation podcast, and we'll see how people want to listen to it or not. Okay.
Thanks for organizing, Jacob and Lucas.
Yeah, I didn't organize, but...
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for organizing.
You're on mute. können wir auch auf Deutsch reden. Du bist immer noch stumm, Lukas.
Aber sieht gut aus, wie er die Lippen bewegt.
Ach shit, ja, okay, jetzt habe ich es wieder. Ja, ich finde es interessant, so was daraus wird, wie viel Zuspruch der Podcast findet. Ja, Mann. Und vielen Dank fürs Organisieren.
Ich denke, erstmal wird das keinen Zuspruch haben. Das Gute ist, man kann die ganzen, ich meine, das ist jedes Mal so, dass der Anfang, es muss erstmal so ein bisschen ins Rollen kommen. Und dann gibt es auch zwischendurch so relativ lange stille Phasen, die hätte man wahrscheinlich nicht, wenn man sich entweder noch besser kennte oder klarer wäre, in welche Richtung die Unterhaltung gehen soll, wenn man jetzt irgendwie sich vorher stärker eine Agenda geben würde. Aber das Gute ist, das kann man ja rausschneiden. Insofern,
probieren. Wie willst du den anpreisen? So, was für Plattformen nutzt du? Ich habe von sowas keine Ahnung, wie geht man sowas an?
Es gibt... Also erstmal gibt es unterschiedliche Bearbeitungssoftwares und dann gibt es Unmengen von Podcatchern und wir werden es wahrscheinlich auf die Internetseite von dem German American Exchange hochladen. Kann man so, das sieht dann so aus, als wäre es ein YouTube-Video ohne Video. Webplayer heißt das. Und erstmal werden das wahrscheinlich die Leute, die eigentlich mitmachen wollten, aber dann an dem Tag doch nicht konnten, die hören sich das vielleicht dann an oder nicht. Ich würde allen empfehlen, das immer auf doppelter Geschwindigkeit zu hören, sonst ist es ziemlich langweilig, weil wenn man über Dinge nachdenkt, dann dauert es manchmal länger, Sachen rauszubringen. Das gilt natürlich umso mehr für all uns, die nicht native sind.
Ja. Ja, aber wenn ich da mal kurz so reingrätsche, ich glaube, das ist ja auch immer noch mal, kommt ja auch mal drauf an, was es für ein Podcast ist. Ne? Und das ist ja wirklich einer... Ich sage jetzt auch, der auch ein bisschen in die Tiefe geht und wahrscheinlich auch Themen hat, die jetzt nicht hier über Lady Gaga oder sonst was sind, sage ich jetzt mal, wo, muss man ja auch ehrlich sein, sich jetzt auch nicht die Allgemeinheit wahrscheinlich so in der Tiefe mit befasst. Aber die Leute, die sich denn so einen Podcast anhören, die hören sich das dann wahrscheinlich oder auch wirklich mal länger als eine Minute anhören, die hören sich das ja auch aus einem Grund an. Die hören sich das ja auch aus dem Grund an, dass es die wirklich auch, ich sag mal, interessiert, weil sie sich auch damit befassen. Und da natürlich diese Punkte, wie du auch gesagt hast, mit der Stille zwischendurch oder dass man natürlich dann noch mehr Redefluss hat, dann einfach wie allgemein. Das kommt, denke ich, aber ich glaube schon, dass die Leute, dann, die sich damit auch befassen wollen, dann auch so anspricht. Dann, ne?
Ich meine, das ist ja das Medium-Podcast auch, dass man sich so seine kleinen Nischen raussucht. Und was jetzt bei uns besonders ist, es gibt ja, es ist ja kein Experten-Talk in dem Sinne, sondern eigentlich einfach einen, ich sag mal, interessierten Talk und dann die, die das sich anhören wollen, die sind ja dann auch auf dem gleichen Niveau. Wer sich jetzt wirklich informieren will, für den ist das wiederum nichts, außer man will sich darüber informieren, wie denkt so eine Community über Dinge nach. Und ich meine, es ist jetzt das erste Mal, dass wir es aufnehmen mit dem Sinn, es auch hochzuladen. Das spielt, macht auch nochmal zumindest für mich einen Unterschied, weil ich das natürlich dadurch, dass ich es vorbereite, noch stärker auch im Kopf habe. Ich fand das mit dem Abspielen von den Soundbits, das hast du, Sophia, glaube ich, jetzt gar nicht mitbekommen. Vorher habe ich immer so kurze Ausschnitte aus den Texten, die ich eingelesen hatte, vorgespielt. Ich finde es eigentlich gut, weil man dann so ein bisschen Hintergrund geben kann, nur ich muss sie besser einbetten. Das heißt, ich muss stärker einleiten, was kommt und dann auch zwei Sätze schon mir vorher überlegt haben, wie ich dann abmoderieren kann, sodass es leichter ist, in die Diskussion einzusteigen. Aber ich hoffe, ihr geht mit mir überein, dass fürs erste Mal es schon okay war.
Ja, war echt cool. Also ich fand auch gerade den Point, den du gemacht hast, dass das so ein Interessierten-Talk ist irgendwie. Ganz gut, oder ich finde jetzt gut getroffen, weil man halt, und das kann ich zumindest über mich selber sagen, dass ich hier manchmal auch einfach sozusagen einen unreflektierten Gedanken oder einen Gedanken, über den ich jetzt noch nicht ewig nachgedacht habe, was halt ein Experte garantiert gemacht hätte, äußern konnte und dann habe ich auch recht schnell mein das Kontra bekommen oder so, aber ich finde auch, das kann dann auch das für einen Hörer interessant machen, dem dann vielleicht die gleichen Gedanken kommen, wie ein solcher Gedanke dann ausdiskutiert wird. Insofern könnte ich mir auch vorstellen, dass da eine Nische da ist. Ob wir sie erreichen, ist natürlich eine andere Frage. Aber
ja, aber Nischen können ja auch 10 Leute sein, theoretisch. Und ich meine, was eben auch noch dazu kommt, und da kommt mir dann Clubhouse in einer gewissen Weise entgegen, weil ich ja eigentlich immer gedacht habe, dass es so ein Redeformat ist, wo auch Leute sich einfach dazuschalten können. Ja, das ist jetzt irgendwann, vielleicht kann man das parallel sogar mal machen. Aber insofern Leute, die sagen, oh, das ist ja ganz interessant, die können uns auch eine E-Mail schreiben und sagen, beim nächsten Mal rede ich einfach mit. Jetzt waren wir heute zu sechs, da genau, zu sechs in Maximalzahl zumindest, dann hätten wir auch noch andere Audioaufnahme-Sachen benutzen können. Bis zu 6 Tonspuren kann man nicht bei Studio Link, heißt das, kann man da aufnehmen. Jetzt haben wir nur Zoom, das ist natürlich qualitativ ein bisschen schlechter. Aber auch das ist jetzt fürs erste Mal okay und dann nach und nach gucken wir mal, wie das funktioniert. Und es ist natürlich auch, wenn irgendwann sich mal ein harter Kern, die fast jedes Mal dabei sind, herausarbeitet, dann hilft das natürlich auch jedes Mal der Unterhaltung, einfach weil man einschätzen kann, wie denkt jemand über was nach und so weiter. Ja. Ich danke euch jedenfalls, dass ihr mitgemacht habt.
Vielen Dank fürs Organisieren.
So viel Spaß gemacht hat, dass ihr beim nächsten Mal auch wieder dabei seid.
Schön, ja. Jeden Fall.
Ja. Dann
euch noch einen schönen Abend.
Euch auch schönen Abend.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Tschüss zusammen.